Well, we at JLIC at Queens College is very proud to have with us today Dr. David Pelkovitz, who has been graciously in partnership with the YU Speakers Bureau coming to OUJLIC at Queens College. Dr. Pelkovitz holds the Gwendolyn Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education Administration, where I graduated from and Michael will soon graduate from. And Dr. Pelkovitz is also an instructor in pastoral counseling at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, YU Smicha, which I graduated from and Michael will hopefully soon graduate from. Dr. Pelkovitz received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics related to education, parenting, and child mental health. He has consulted extensively within the Jewish community in the United States, Europe, and Israel on a wide range of issues facing children and adolescents. There wasn't enough room on the page for his whole bio because of Dr. Pelkovitz's incredible accomplishments and impact on the Jewish world. One of the minor impacts on the Jewish world that he's had was on me personally. It was a big zechut that I had to be in Dr. Pelkovitz's class, not even in graduate school. I didn't know at the time that I was going to be going to Azrieli, and I was actually very nervous that I wouldn't get a chance to soak in the wisdom for Dr. Pelkovitz. So I fought with the administration. We all know how complicated and red tape there can be with college administrations to take Dr. Pelkovitz's graduate class while I was still an undergrad. And it was one of the highlights of my undergraduate and graduate career. Nothing changed when I went to graduate school. It was still one of the best classes that I took. And we've spoken about many issues over time, and Dr. Pelkovitz has just been such a great mentor, friend, and really somebody that I look up to. It's incredibly fortunate for us to be able to have him here again here at Queens College with OUJLIC, to hear with him speak about topics including happiness and as it relates to other. And prayer.
Thank you. Thank you for the very warm introduction. Okay. So to 110. Okay. Great. Very good. Okay. Very good. So, hello, everybody. Just to give you some perspective on where I'm coming from, I'm a clinical psychologist. And my main area for most of my career before I ended up at YU was hospital-based. So I was director of psychology at Northwell Hospital or something. The reason I'm saying that is a lot of the stories I'm going to be telling when we talk about the psychology of happiness comes from work I did there. Because my research and clinical specialty there was with post-traumatic stress disorder, with trauma, with terror, with working with kids with cancer, all those kinds of situations. And that's where I got a lot of the thoughts I'm going to be sharing with you and a lot of the stories you're going to be hearing. Okay? So that's by way of beginning. Let me start by contrasting the word happiness to the Hebrew word simcha. So let's start with the word happiness. Anybody want to guess the etymology of the word happiness? I'll give you a hint. Hapless, haphazard, happenstance all have the same prefix. So what do you think the prefix H-A-P might be about? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Yeah.
Sounds almost like something that just happens to you.
Ah, very good.
It occurs.
Yeah, happens by chance. Yeah, is that? Yeah. So that's right. It's b'mikre, something that kind of it's tied to the word for chance and happenstance. It's by luck, and which is very much what the secular view of happiness is. What do you think the average American says would take to make him or her more happy?
Money,
right? Absolutely. That's pretty much almost by a huge percentage. That's the typical secular view of happiness, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what the research says about the money happiness connection. And simcha is very different. So I'm going to share with you two quick vignettes. Okay, we're going to call this the double enigma. Okay, on happiness. Enigma number one. Is I'm sitting at a High Lifeline retreat, probably about 15 years ago, right? An organization for kids with cancer. And I'm sitting on Shabbos afternoon, hanging out with the parents and talking. And one of the parents, who happened to have been a Satmar Chassid, those retreats had people from all walks of life, ranging from Hasidim to intermarried couples. So at that point, one of the Hasidim sort of lets out a sigh. He says, this Rosh Hashanah, my son was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. 10 days later, I'm sitting in shul on Yom Kippur, and a wave of happiness washes over me like I've never experienced in my whole life. And I think this guy said, what's he talking about? I literally didn't know what he was talking about. Then I see all the other parents there, about 40 other pairs of parents, are nodding with tears in their eyes, nodding with agreement. So I realize I have to rethink my understanding of happiness. Then there's this similar enigma, and I'll answer both enigmas in a few minutes, but the similar enigma goes like this. It's a scene that you may remember from Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. I'm sure many of you have read that book, or if not, you'll be reading it. It's hard to get through college without reading Man's Search for Meaning. So as you know, Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist before he was put in the concentration camp. And he was in the camps, but luckily got assigned to be the physician in the typhus ward in the camp he was in. And he describes literally the last minute of a 20-year-old woman's life in the camps. And here's how he describes the last minute of her life. She calls him over, and she's literally spending the last minute of her life. She says, Dr. Frankl, I'm looking up through the slats in the roof at the beautiful blue sky, at the beautiful clouds, and I'm looking up at nature. I'm looking up at God's beautiful world. She said, until I came to this horrible place, I was a frivolous teenager. I didn't know what was important. I didn't know what was not important. And she says, now that I'm looking up at God's beautiful world, I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And she closes her eyes and dies. Enigma number two. How can you describe that experience as happy? Right? So both those experiences are clearly simcha. And they're clearly different than the happiness that we described. But I'm going to get to explaining the double enigma there, those two stories that are clearly inherent contradictions. But first, let's explore a little bit the money-happiness connection, okay? Latest I've heard is once you make about $75,000 a year, this is the work of Dr. Kahneman, he's the nephew of the Panovitcher Rebbe and the winner of the Nobel laureate in economics, but he's a psychologist. So Dr. Kahneman's latest research shows $75,000. After you make $75,000 a year, meaning once your basic needs are met, okay, not if you send your kids to yeshiva, you need a lot more than that. But $75,000 a year is the cutoff point nowadays. And once you have your basic needs met that way, then there's absolutely no difference between somebody who's wealthy and somebody who's poor in terms of happiness level. As one of the literature reviews on the money-happiness connection says, you could be driving down Broadway in a bus on your way to your blue-collar job as a construction worker on Wall Street. And in the lane next to you, in this limousine, chauffeur-driven limousine, there could be a billionaire who's on his or her way to their job in a penthouse, at the bottom of Wall Street, doing mega deals, okay? And if you try to predict the happiness of those two people, you would utterly fail. It would be random, totally random. Because you can't tell for money what a person's happiness level will be. But here's the, I'll give you my favorite story on it, okay? My favorite story on the money-happiness connection goes like this, because stories will illustrate for you the reality of it. It's the story of Robert Frank. So Robert Frank is a guy who is a pretty wealthy guy today. Pretty wealthy, well-known writer, economist, lecturer, and he's well off. Because of the way he invested his money. And Robert Frank talks about the following experience when he graduated from college. So he was a very idealistic guy. He graduates from college and he volunteers for the Peace Corps. Do they still have the Peace Corps? the piano? Do you guys even know what the P score is? Ooh, wow. That's so interesting. Yeah. Times change. Peace Corps used to be, it may not even exist anymore, but in very idealistic times, many people, after they graduate college, would give 2 years, like a Sherut Lumi, 2 years, of volunteering to be sent around the world to just do chesed around the world. And you didn't have a choice on where you'd be assigned, but it was a way of, paying back for what you got, okay? So Robert Frank graduates college, and he decides to give 2 years to the Peace Corps. And they fly him to Nepal. They assign him to Nepal. They pick him up in a van when he gets to the airport in Nepal. And they take him on a 12-hour drive into the middle of nowhere. And they drop him off, and they say to him, you're going to be spending the next 2 years here teaching kids. And it's a very impoverished part of Nepal. So they say, bye, we'll see you in 2 years. Okay? Now, here's what they give him for living accommodations. A one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. Could you imagine? This is a guy from a privileged, wealthy background. And they're saying you're going to be spending the next 2 years in a one-room hut, no running water, no electricity. So he's in a state of despair. He just doesn't know, how he's going to handle it. Then he says it's very interesting what happened. He discovers that nobody in that part of Nepal is living any better. And he says it's amazing how quickly he got used to it. He said it didn't even require a week. In 2-3 days, he was totally used to living in this hovel. But here's where the story gets interesting. He gets his first paycheck. Now, his first paycheck is for $40 a month. $40 a month. Now, in my neighborhood, okay, I live in Great Neck, okay? So in Great Neck, if you gave a kid $40 a week for allowance, they'd call the Child Protective Service people to report you, okay? But $40 a month? He said, there's no way I'm going to be able to live on $40 a month. He says, I have to figure out how to get the heck out of here, but I have to get out of here. And then something very interesting happens. He discovers that nobody in that part of Nepal is making more than $30 a month. So he's making $10 more than anybody else in that part of the country. And he goes on to say that he never felt wealthier in his life than he did living on $40 a month in a one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. Because so much of our perception and our happiness and our perception of what's enough is tied to what psychologists call relative deprivation. I once have a guy in my office. It was the end of December, so it was bonus time. And he was clinically depressed. He was incredibly depressed. He was a little suicidal. So I asked him, let me hear what's going on. So he says, well, I just got my bonus, my end of year bonus. So I said, okay, and why are you depressed? He said, it was $500,000. I said, okay. He was 28, this guy. Okay. Says, so you're depressed, why? And he said, because the guy in the office next to me, who's nowhere near as good as I am, he got $750,000. So to him, it was all about the comparison. And that's human nature. Human nature, it's the principle of relative deprivation. We tend to, unless we understand that happiness lies in ourself, that happiness lies in the connection to ourself, which is what we're getting to, it's not going to be good. You're never going to have a sense of satisfaction or having an idea of money being enough, right? You've all learned about Yesh Li Rav versus Yesh Li Kol, right? So we know that, the two brothers, when they talk to each other, encapsulates it, right? Yaakov has the fateful meeting with Esav, and Esav, in catching his brother up with how his life is going, says Yesh Li Rav, which implies, I have a lot, but that implies, but it's never enough. It's never enough. Yesh Li Kol, which is what Yaakov says, means I have everything. And it's all in your perception. It's all whether or not you feel you have enough. It's the sense of internal deprivation that fuels the sense of dissatisfaction with money. Okay, let me move on. What I'll do now is let's just take a minute to talk about the bottom line, which is, what's the answer, first of all, to the double enigma? Double enigma, how could that chassid have described 10 days after his son's ominous diagnosis with cancer? And how could the woman in her last minute of life talk about being happy? It's what the Chazon Ish says, and here's the answer to the enigma. And the answer to what happiness, what simcha is opposed to happiness. Here's what the Chazon Ish says. For he who knows the light of truth, there's no sadness in the world. Again, for he who knows the light of truth, there's no sadness in the world. Okay? What was that chassid experiencing 10 days after his son's diagnosis? He was experiencing connection to what we know is inevitably and invariably tied to happiness. It's the three F's. Anybody want to guess what the three F's are? What are the three F's?
Faith.
Faith, very good.
Family.
Family, good.
Friends.
And friends. So it's three. So literally, family, friends, and faith. Usually, very few people get faith right away, so I'm impressed with that.
It's our Queen's group.
It must be the Queen's. It must be the wonderful job you guys are doing. Because usually, like if I speak to a high school group on this topic, everybody gets family and friends. And then the third F, girls usually guess food. Which is interesting. And the boys in high school, they just smile. So I don't know why. Okay? So, okay. Let's keep going. Okay. So, now let's get to Purim. We're going to get to Purim, then we're going to get to some other stuff. We'll figure it out. Okay? So here's the Purim stuff. So the Purim stuff goes like this. We're going to talk about straight lines. We might talk a little bit about circles. We're going to talk about the geometry of happiness, Jewish perspectives. But Purim is about the straight line of happiness. What am I talking about? To the extent that you're connected to yourself and to your goals and know where you're going, that's when you're most likely to be happy. When you're connected to your inner essence, to your unique signature strengths. Do you learn in any of your course about signature strengths? Do you have any positive psychology stuff here? Signature strengths it's sort of a fun thing to do. And there are a number of tests you could take, but the easiest way to know what your signature strengths are is you ask your friends, you ask your family, when am I at my best? You know, give me a list of my greatest hits when you thought I was really alive, when I shined. And then you discover for yourself what it is, and then there are tests that you could take for free on the University of Pennsylvania Positive Psychology site, and it's AuthenticHappiness.com, Dr. Seligman's site. But basically, you take a test for free, and you get a big printout with your five top signature strengths. When you exercise your signature strengths, you know, what you're put on this world to do, the inner essence, or as Rav Kook would say, everybody is betoch tocho doleg ner, has a fire burning in their inner essence. And then he says, and there isn't anybody shein lo ner, everybody has a flame. He says, and your job is to discover what your flame is, which is the real root of happiness, and then to lahaviko lavuka gadola, to take your inner flame and set a bonfire going, lahair ha'olam kulo. Set the world ablaze with your inner uniqueness. And everybody has it. And now we have sort of the technology to figure out what it is. But the simplest thing is, you know, when you're exercising a signature strength, you're alive. You don't get tired. You're always looking for new ways to exercise it. Now, it may be hard to know exactly what it is at this stage in your life because you haven't been exposed enough. But the bottom line is that one of the keys to happiness is the key to connecting to your inner self. Okay, I'm going to make it more clear in a minute, and this is very much tied to the concept of Purim. But here, listen to what Rabbi Dr. Akiva Tatz says. You're all familiar with Rabbi Tatz's work. I got to spend a week with him. I'm very excited. In 2 months, we to a conference together in Switzerland, a Jewish medical ethics conference. And I'm always amazed at his wisdom. For those of you who don't know, he's a surgeon who then became religious and has amazing writings on topics like this. Brilliant, brilliant man. But listen to what he writes on happiness, and it gets to this aspect of simcha that I'm highlighting. So according to this, you know what simcha is? Shem moach. It's where your head is at. Happiness is about the ephemeral. We all know the year after you win the lottery, you're more depressed than beforehand. So anybody here who wins the lottery, let me know about it. We'll take care of it. Okay? But here's what Akiva Tetz, what Rabbi Dr. Tetz says about happiness. Real happiness is what you experience when you're doing what you should be doing. When you're moving clearly along your own road, your unique path to your unique destination, you experience real happiness. When you're moving along the path that leads to the deep discovery of who you really are, when you're building the essence of your own personality and creating yourself, a deep happiness wells up within you. The journey doesn't cause happiness. The journey is the happiness itself. You know, I was down in the Southern Hemisphere a couple of years ago. And I gave a talk touching on this, on the importance of finding your uniqueness. It wasn't a talk on happiness, but it was tied to a lot of what we're talking about today. And it was either Australia or South Africa. I don't even remember because I travel a lot and everything blurs. But I talked about what we just talked about. In that shul, in that community, some people, you know, it was a Shabbos morning talk. So there were people who pointed at a man, an older man. They say, "See that guy there? He's the leading physician, not only in our country, he's the leading physician in the whole continent. This man is a brilliant, brilliant doctor. He's the one everybody goes to, even from around the world, because he's so brilliant in being a doctor." So I was shocked when I talked about this, and he comes over to me, and there are tears in his eyes. He says, "Dr. Pelkovitz, let me tell you something." He said, "I'm now in my 80s. Now in my very, very youthful looking guy, but he says, "I'm now in my 80s. He said, "When I was growing up, all I wanted to do was be an architect. He says, "I used to walk around the streets of the city here when I was a little boy with a sketch pad. And all I would do was draw my vision of the buildings I wanted to build on every block of this city. Those were my dreams. I thought about it. It was my passion. It was all I wanted to accomplish in life. Then I hit the point that I had to apply to school to become an architect. And my parents said, "No way." They said, "No way." They said, "Architects don't make enough money. You have a responsibility to us, maybe to take care of us in our old age. You will be a doctor. You will be a doctor." And he said, "But I don't want to be a doctor." They said, "That's okay, you don't have to want to be a doctor, but you will be a doctor." And then he became this incredibly successful doctor and a wealthy guy. Then he looks at me, again with tears in his eyes, he says, "I got to tell you something." He says, "There isn't a day that goes by that I don't continue to walk the streets of this city with that pad in my pocket. And I still dream about and I sketch all the buildings I wish I could have built." He says, "It never went away. It never went away at all. It's all I really care about." Sad, sad, and hard to be the kind of happy that we're talking about in terms of Shem Moach. Your head being in a place of connection to the inner essence of who you are. So here's one thought, and now we're gonna tie this a little bit to the story of Purim. So here's the, because this will lead up to understanding the straight line. Okay. There's a saying, goes back to the 1500s, the Shla, 1400s, 1500s. And here's what the saying is. And it goes like this. It's Ein, you ever hear this? Ein ba'olam simcha katara tasvekot. There's no greater joy than the resolution of doubt. Okay? Now, why is that? When you're not connected, let's say you're going out with somebody and you're getting serious with them and you're just not sure, is he for you? Is she for you? you're just not sure. And you're kind of agonizing over it, okay? And then you decide to break up. And there's part of you that's very sad when you break up. It's not easy to break up. It's the loss of your future vision of what your life was going to be like. But then there's a little piece of you that's probably also happy, because what have you had? Hatarat hasvekot. You've had a resolution of that. Anybody here ever experienced that? A little bit of a resolution when you have that hatarat hasvekot, okay? So what's that about? It's about when you're on a straight line, knowing where you're going to, knowing who you are, and being connected to yourself. That's when you're happy. When you don't know where you stand, I'll tell you another story. Wait, am I being smart about the stories? No, I better control myself. Okay, I have a good story, but I want to save my stories for the essential stuff now, because I have to start to think about getting to the end, because I want some time for questions. So let me just tie it now to Pesach, to Purim. Okay, so here's the deal with Purim. On the idea of a straight line, on the idea of the straight line being tied to happiness. Because what's the straight line? The straight line is a symbolism. Here's one of the nicest things I've ever heard about the straight line. It's from Yaakov Asher Sinclair in Yerushalayim. Any of you know him there? Listen to what he says. He says, when you move in a straight line, every step in that line is a product of one that precedes it. Every step carries the sum of where you've come from. Every step, every moment in that straight line demands the next step. Then he goes on to say that without outside intervention, a straight line will never stop. But what happens when the line leaves its straight path, like that doctor who wanted to be an architect? And wanders. A line that twists and turns must eventually falter and end. Its own deviance spells its eventual demise. Okay? When the line twists, nothing has any connection to anything else. The world is random. There's no purpose, no beginning, no end. That's the story of Purim. Okay? How's it the story of Purim? Amalek, right, is, first of all, the essence of Suffolk, the essence of disconnection. It's the enemy of the straight line of purpose. First of all, let's talk about it from a fascinating standpoint. What's the gematria of Amalek? The same gematria as the word Suffolk. The same gematria as the word doubt. Work it out, okay? It's also an anagram from Ukal, crooked. And in a fascinating way, in Kabbalistic thinking, you know what the symbol is for Amalek? A zvuv, a fly. How does a fly fly? Random. Okay? So what's happening here, when you look at this aspect of Purim and happiness, what we're talking about is it's a very deep truth that can help guide your life in terms of the stage of life that you're all in. Okay? You're all in a stage of life where you're going to be making decisions that are going to take you either on a straight line of finding who you are in terms of who you might end up with in permanent relationships, in terms of where you might end up, in terms of decisions about how you're going to use your inner signature strengths. I mean, not to get you nervous, but as you know, very much you're at a stage of life that you want to try to stay connected to that straight line. Because if you don't, that's the mu'ukal. That's the deviance. That's the suffix. That's what Purim, in some ways, is all about. So I'll just read this to you a little bit. The letters of Amalek spell mu'ukal, which means twisting. Amalek is the force that skews the straight line, turning it aside. Okay? And it takes history and purpose and turns them into a million frozen random moments. What does it mean, Asher Karcha Baderech? They didn't recognize that anybody has a unique mission or has a unique signature strength or a unique purpose in the world. To them, everything is random. Everything is purposeless. And that's philosophically what Purim is all about. It's tied to why we put on disguises. It's tied to the integration of our inner and outer selves. We won't go into it in much more detail than that, other than to say, here, this is the essence of the Amalek personality. Okay? The doubt means where I've come from is irrelevant, and where I'm going to is uncertain. All I know is now, the moment. And in fact, the highest rate of suicide attempts are people who feel disconnected. So let's say you look at first-generation Americans in this country, highest rate in adolescent children of immigrants, highest rate of depression and suicidality. When I was running, one of my hats at the hospital was director of research in the psychiatry department. So our psychiatry residents and fellows had to do a research project. So one of the women who was just doing her 6 months on our adolescent psychiatry inpatient unit, she comes to me, she says, I did 10 psychiatric admissions in the last couple of weeks for adolescent suicide attempts. 9 out of the 10 were first generation Americans. So she says, do you think there's anything there? I said, look, let's research it. And she did a wonderful study and found exactly that. What was the tzad hashava? What was the commonality of those suicide attempts? It was people who felt like they didn't belong anywhere. They didn't belong in the world of their parents because their parents came from a whole different culture. Their parents didn't understand them. And they didn't feel fully accepted by their friends here. And they felt like they were literally twisting. They weren't connected to the line. Does that make sense? So there's that part of happiness. Let me, where can I go with this? Okay. Let me just, could do circles, or I could, you know what, I'm going to do something else instead. I'm going to do stories. You'll remember the stories. You won't remember any of that. You won't remember all the Jewish stuff and Purim. That's okay. Here's the stories are what you'll hold on to. So I'm going to end with two stories, and then we'll have discussion. Okay? And that should get us just right. Here's story number one. Okay? I'm at a High Lifeline retreat. It's a number of years ago. And I'm sitting next to a well-known oncologist, the head of oncology at Sloan Kettering Memorial. Okay, it's Shabbos morning. And a guy gets up to give this speech on Shabbos morning. Big strapping guy. He's introduced as a doctor. Okay? Had no idea who he was, and I'd been doing the retreat since they started 25 years ago. And I say, who is this guy? And the guy sitting next to me, who's a real rationalist, he says, you're about to hear a story that I have no medical explanation for. He says, you're going to hear his story. I can't explain this story. And here's the story. The doctor gets up and he says the following. He says, a number of years ago, Camp Simcha, the camp for children with cancer, was co-ed. They had boys and girls together. And I was about 18, and I was very sick. I had a terrible prognosis. And there was another 18-year-old person, they were a girl, who was also very sick. No, neither of us were supposed to make it. And we met in Camp Simcha. I remember when this happened, because there was a lot of discussion. Should they be allowed to get married? They fall in love, and they get engaged. And everybody was very nervous. They said, this isn't going to end up well. It's not going to end up well. There's no way they're going to be able to have a life together, because they're both so incredibly sick. But I think wisely, everybody agreed, but who are we to rob them of their happiness? Let them get married. He lived in a different part of the world. He lived in the Southern Hemisphere. And he has to go home to prepare for his wedding. So he flies, I think it was to South Africa. He flies to South Africa. And his plane lands. This is before the age of the cell phone. And immediately they page him saying, you know, so-and-so, come to us. He goes to the front desk of the airline that flew him. And they say, listen, we just got terrible news. Your fiance is deathly ill. She wants you to immediately fly back. She wants to say goodbye to you. This is what he's told. This is before 9/11. They immediately allowed him right back on the plane. They didn't even unpack his luggage. And they allow him to head right back to JFK. Very long flight. I think it's a 22-hour flight. No, I forget. It's a long flight. It's a long, long flight. And he lands quickly for Uber, so he takes a taxi, And he rushes to Sloan Kettering Memorial, where the guy sitting next to me is the in charge of the care. And he's waiting there to meet him. And he says, quick, go see her. You have to say goodbye to her. And he goes. And the first thing that hits him is the look of uniqueness that he fell in love with. The spark in her eyes is gone. The chain, she just, because she has something called a cushionoid look. Her face is all puffed up from high-level steroids. And he's devastated by everything, but especially by that. He runs to the payphone. He calls his rabbi and says, quick, come immediately. You have to marry us. I'm told she has very little time. I don't want her to die without us being married. The rabbi rushes, and he drives immediately to Manhattan, runs in, and he talks to her. And she's kind of in and out of consciousness, and he says, I feel terrible, but the marriage wouldn't take hold. In order for marriage to take hold, she has to be batas. She has to be conscious. She has to be, you know, have clarity of thought. Even if I married you, it wouldn't be a real marriage. He says, let's hope that she'll come. She'll come too in some way, and I'll be able to marry, but I can't right now. So the doctor comes in, and he's now crying hysterically. He says, look, he says, I'm going to arrange for you to have privacy. I'm going to clear out this whole area of the ICU. Say goodbye to her. Now, he hadn't davened yet. He had just come in from South Africa. And he puts on his talis and tefillin. He starts davening. He says to himself, look, I can't daven for a cure. He says, you're not allowed. I can't have unrealistic expectations. He says, but you know what? If I could have one thing, just one thing, you know what I'd like? I want just for a minute for her to get back the spark in her face, the beauty of her uniqueness, that sparkle in her eye. And he davened Shemoneh Esrei, and he screams out at the top of his lungs when he gets up to this part of Sim Shalom, Kulanu ke'echad ba'ar panecha, God, just for a minute, give me back the ke'echad ba'ar panecha, the reflection of your divine light. Let it come back and be reflected in her face and in her eyes. That's all, just 1 minute, that's all I'm asking for. And he's continuing to tell the story. And before he could go on, two little kids come up to him and say, Abba, Abba, and start pushing on his leg. And the doctor's sitting next to me and says, that's their children. That's their children. Because after that Kulanu Ke'echad Ba'ar Panecha, this isn't a story of faith healing. Nobody understands. The doctor kept saying, I have no explanation for this. I don't know why it happened. I don't know how it happened. But from that moment, she starts to get well. From that moment, she gets the sparkle back in her eye. From that moment, she starts to regain her strength, and she recovers. She has a remission from her cancer, and he has a remission from his cancer. And they get married, and they have children. And he goes to medical school, and is today an oncologist at that same hospital. He's a cancer specialist at that same hospital. Unfortunately, he recently had a remission. Okay? After many, many wonderful years, though, and raising a family, and God willing, he recently had a relapse. God willing, he'll have another remission. It's happened before. It could happen again. So he's not so well now. But the bottom line is, it's a story about the spark of uniqueness, the spark of the power of understanding connection to others, connection to ourselves as a source of simcha. And now I'll end with the final story and we'll have some time for questions. My main area is trauma. So I was invited to Sri Lanka after the tsunami for a couple of weeks. I get pulled to Israel after a terror attack sometimes. And I get invited to different places when there's trauma going on. But here, this is my favorite story on Simcha. And it's about something that happened a few years ago. I get invited every few years. Companies that benefit from slave labor during World War II, during the horrible years of the Shoah, by German law, they have to pay to have all the survivors who still live in Europe come. They put them up in a hotel for a week, and they have chizuk. They have talks, they have group therapy, they're Russian therapists who are Jewish, who are you know, specializing in working with them, are there also, and it's an amazing, amazing 3-4 days that I spend there every few years. And the last conference, there was a man there, a survivor, who had been in the camps in his teenage years, and he was the happiest man I ever met in my life. He had a simcha, he had a joie de vivre, a joy of life. He was the essence of simcha, not happiness, but of simcha. And, you know, happiness is contagious. You know, when you're happy, you're healthy, you're more socially successful, you do better in life when you're happy for a whole variety of reasons. And everybody was hanging around him because he just made you feel good. You get a little piece of his light. And it's the last day of the conference. We're all at the hotel packing up. We're about to go back to the airport to go home. And I go over to him and I say to him, you know, we spent the last 3 days together, the last 4 days together. I say, there's a beautiful Hebrew saying, Ma'at min ha'or do chaharbe min ha'choshech. Little sparks of light push away a great deal of darkness. I said, what's your source of light? Where does that simcha come from? And he looked a little embarrassed. And he said, look, he said, you know what I went through? We talked about it throughout the week in our groups. And he was a very articulate man. He said, look, I'll remind you, as if I needed to be reminded. He talked about the roll calls at 3, 4 in the morning in sub-freezing temperature. And he's an adolescent. And if you go too slow, they put the dogs on to devour you. Okay? If you fall down, they machine gun you to death. And he had a way of talking that he sort of pulled you there. He said, you want to know what got me through all those years in the camps? And you know how I survived, especially those horrible roll calls? He said, I developed the ability to picture in my head the feeling on my head, feeling of warmth on my head, when my father would bench me, would give me a bracha every Friday night. And I developed the ability to smell the sweetness of his breath when he bent down to kiss me every Friday night. You want to know the source of the simcha? The source of the simcha was that bracha, right? And that's really what it's about, what happiness is about. I don't mean the fake happiness. I mean what simcha is all about. Encapsulated in that bracha, okay, was everything we're talking about here. It was connection to faith. Connection to family, connection to community, connection to the enduring. And when you have that, you have a lesson in life that's the essence of what Purim is all about. So thank you, everybody, and we have about 10 minutes for discussion. Okay? Ask away. Okay? Yeah, please.
Yes, I want to talk a little bit about how you said that, like, true happiness comes from, like, a person's, like, inner essence and, like, doing what you feel is, like, your purpose.
Right.
And, like, staying on that straight line. So, doesn't that change within a person over the course of their lifetime, maybe over and over again? And also, is that necessarily, like, an occupation? Like, because I'm sure you've got people who are doing something they love, but they're not happy with it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Two excellent questions. Yeah. So, yeah. We, in Azrieli now, we spend time with the course I teach, is we, everybody does the signature strength test. We do all kinds of things to help people understand it because it has real applications for education. It does change. Our life changes. The way you are now in terms of personality, in 20 years from now, you'll probably be very, very different. You'll probably be very different religiously. You'll probably be very different in terms of the kind of things that connect you. We're ever evolving organisms, you know? But there's a certain core that I think does, for the most part, I think stay somewhat stable. It doesn't mean it doesn't change. You could develop different interests and different skills that you never even dreamed that you'd have. And then you could become passionate about it. So it changes. But I think in terms of, so let's say your strength pattern is a combination of generosity, gratitude, spirituality, and teaching. Something like that. Okay? Over time, It might change a little bit, but the essence of who you are, which is, you know, somebody who's a connector as opposed to, you know, the other way around, it's gonna be more or less tied to that. Can you get it in your job? Not necessarily. Like, the story of the architect is not, you know, it's not an unusual story, but you could get it somewhere in your life. If you keep exercising the areas that you're passionate about, you'll find a way to serve the community with it. You'll find a way to use it in a variety of ways, and you'll find that as long as you keep developing your talents and your skills and your interests, as long as you don't keep it to yourself, like Rav Kook says, okay? There's another component of this that I just wanted to share with you since I mentioned Rav Kook, okay? And that's this magnificent thought that he has that I'll just share with you, and this is really another key to being internal and you're being tied to the straight line. Yesh ben chorin sherucho ruach shalev. He says there are free people who have the spirit of a slave. Yesh eved sherucho malei acheros. And there are slaves who have a spirit filled with freedom. Somebody whose entire life is just about what's good and right in the eyes of others, whoever, he'll always be a slave. Okay? And that's really the essence. You can't do it. Okay? And then he goes on to say the essence of finding yourself is the ability to not just do mashatov yafa b'ene acherem, okay? But instead, he says, ha'nemon la'atzmi yuso ben chorinhu. Somebody who's faithful to his or her inner essence will always be free. And that's hard. That's a challenge. It's very hard to really be internal and do what's right. But it's another key to happiness. Okay, you know, okay? So, I hear what you're asking. I hear you're asking about the longitudinal stability of it. It's a good question. But my impression over time is there's a certain stability to, you know, I'm thinking about some of my friends who are old. I don't know how that happened. I'm not old, but they're old. Some of the people I grew up with are old. And they change in a lot of ways, but in terms of their essence, you know, what turns them on in terms of, you know, what their passions are, that's pretty much stayed very, very much the same, you know? Yeah, but good question. Other thoughts? Questions? Yeah, please.
When I was 5 or 6, I wanted to be a rabbi. It was my biggest dream. When I was 10, I wanted to be an architect. And when I was in 8th grade, I wanted to go into sports for, you know, I wanted to go into politics. So you mentioned that there is that core, you know, belief of what that, you know, ultimate goal is, but how do you know when you see it?
Right. Another excellent question. Yes. Yeah, so, right. First of all, that's good. You shouldn't. There's a thing called premature foreclosure. Those of you, sometimes people know exactly what they want to do very early, and if they love it, it's great. But most people fool around a lot till they find, you know, at your age, I would imagine many of you, how many of you know 100% what you want to do with your life? That's nice. Yeah, I don't trust you. I don't know. What? What's that?
This is my answer too.
Yeah, right.
Now I know.
You know. What are you going to do?
I want to go into politics. I want to run for office.
Okay, good,
and
good.
Losing.
I'll vote for you, okay. But the bottom line is that that it's good if it's coming, it has to be internal, it has to be intrinsic, it can't come from external pressure, it has to come from the inside. And when it comes from the inside, it could be good, but many people haven't decided yet. It takes time, and you often have to try different things on for size till you find it. The last thing you want to do is rush into something that's not really what you want to do, you know, and to do it for external kind of reasons. Somebody else was going to ask something? Or Yeah, please.
You talked about people who needed help because they weren't feeling connected to anybody around them. To a lot of people, that was
right.
Cause of depression. How can you help somebody else to make form those connections?
Right. That's an important point. Is that if you see somebody who is dangling, okay, and they're not connected, and they're feeling excluded, and they're acting like they're excluded, and because of that, they're likely to be depressed. It's not so simple. So when you see that, you know what? There's nothing better than just be there for them, okay? You could ask something as simple as, how are you doing? You could ask something as basic as just saying, are you okay? And if they don't want to share it with you, fine. But to just do what you can to include them. Very often, achar pulot nimshachal vavot, our actions, our heart is drawn to our actions. There's an awful lot you could do just by pulling them in gently to the extent that they'll allow you. It does much more than you'd think. You know, there being even somebody who makes it, you know, when somebody feels excluded, you know, there's a term, you're left out in the cold, okay? You know, or you ice somebody out. You know that the research, the psych research shows that literally your skin temperature goes down when that happens? You literally become colder. And it's a very tough place to be. So even something as simple as including them makes an enormous difference, okay?
So, yeah.
I'm sorry?
We're going to stop here.
We're going to stop here. Yeah. Excellent. Very good. I was about to give one more story. No, that's okay. I'll tell you another time. I'll save it for another time. Thank you, everybody. Happy Purim.
Yes. We want to thank once again Dr. Sullivan for coming to join us.